try and find us. There's definitely smaller ones because we use them. And I find if I'm interviewing people in the field, definitely you want it to be as inobtrusive as possible. Otherwise, it puts a distance there.
I understand. Yeah. Unfortunately, this is the state of the art device for oral history. And I've been told one has to record on it. Anyway, we will work with it as we can. So I was just explaining to Armand that, you know, this is it's kind of for an oral history project. Yeah. So I'm going to hopefully take a slightly more detailed, you know, interview and conversation. But what I want to start with just simply is if you could describe who you are and a little bit about your background. You're a medical doctor as well as right. So go ahead. What would
I'll try and be as synthetic as I can, and you can tell me to expand if I don't get any of the better parts. So I am I'm a physician. By training, an emergency physician. I got my training in emergency medicine in the United States and finished that up in 1997 and actually worked for the International Medical Corps in Bosnia while I was in the last year of my emergency medicine training.
Where were you training?
I was trained at the University of Missouri, Kansas City, at Truman Medical Center. And the medical director there sat on the board of the International Medical Corps and had worked in Afghanistan for them during the Russian-Afghan War in the 80s. And so they ran an emergency medicine project in Zenica, Bosnia during the conflict there. And so I took some time out and worked for IMC in Bosnia. And the medical director there said, well, if you like this kind of work, IMC is good. And MSF is also good because he'd worked for both.
And this was in the early 90s?
This is in 96, 97, I was there. Mm-hmm. And so I finished up my training in 97, and several months after that, went into the field with MSF for my first mission with them. So I was in Sri Lanka in 97 with MSF France at the time it was. Anyway, so went through the usual into the field a couple of times with different MSF sections, ending up in Gulu, Uganda, in 2000 for what was then the biggest Ebola outbreak. Well, what was up until 2014 the biggest Ebola outbreak on record, 425 cases. And that was back when Ebola was a much smaller affair with fewer people involved and whatnot.
Sorry, I might just dwell on that a little bit. So just tell me what happened there from your point of view.
Well, so at that point, I was working as an isolation ward physician. So we called it an isolation ward back then. So I was doing patient management. I met my wife there. She's a project coordinator for the MSF Belgium and working as an epidemiologist. And I guess it was at that point that you learn to care for Ebola patients, but you also learn that outbreak management is much more than caring for the patients. And very shortly after that, I went and got a degree in public health at Johns Hopkins.
Before we go, could you tell me what you knew about Ebola? Can you remember, what did you know about Ebola in 2000?
Before going, almost nothing. Right. Just that it was this infrequent disease that happened in Central Africa that the media and certain authors had made bigger than life and rather colorful.
So you had read The Hot Zone, you had heard about
it? No, I knew of The Hot Zone. I think I'd seen one of the various movies that used Ebola as a villain or something. Outbreak, I think it was. I had all of the same images that most people had at that point, with the understanding that they were probably overblown to a certain extent. But I don't think it, you know, when I called up MSF and said, what have you got? And they said, would you like to go to Uganda and work on an Ebola outbreak, that I found it threatening, or, you know, my next line was not, what else have you got? I mean, it was sure, I'll do that. What more? I mean,
You arrived there in Gulu. Are you immediately thrust onto the ward and treating patients?
Yeah, almost. I mean, I think the next day after arriving, the day arriving in Gulu, I met my predecessor, the person I was replacing, who's now working for PAHO. and who I crossed paths with again in Monrovia, this outbreak. She said, this is how you put on the gear.
Mm-hmm.
You know, this is how we're taking care of the patients.
Mm-hmm.
And I think we had an overlap of a day or two. Mm-hmm. She showed me the ropes, and then I kept going.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So what was that like, your first encounter with the clinical, you know, manifestation of the...
Well, I guess I had the same impression that comes up every outbreak. You know, every outbreak,
mm-hmm.
people go to the field and they come back and they say, wow, I expected there to be more blood.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's, I think, a recurring theme that we hear.
Mm-hmm.
And no, they just, you know, Ebola patients just look very, very ill.
Mm-hmm.
To the point where they almost have a characteristic weakness to them. I mean, you can see people
mm-hmm.
come out of the car and sort of walk over to the screening area and whatnot, and you can look
mm-hmm.
at them and say, that person's got Ebola, just
right.
by the way that they move and the way they hold themselves
right.
and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
One of those sort of gestalt impressions that clinicians get
mm-hmm.
After
mm-hmm.
seeing a disease a few times.
Right.
But other than that, I don't think that the management of the disease is, aside from the infection control,
mm-hmm.
Is significantly different from how one would go about other severe diseases. I mean, you know, if you've worked in emergency medicine or intensive care,
mm-hmm.
you're familiar with people and with, you know, critical illness, and I think that's the principles are the same, and the management is the same. And despite all of the fuss internally and in the media and whatnot, the management principles are not
mm-hmm.
outside of how you would manage somebody with a severe bacterial illness that you would find in the hospital here in Europe or North America.
Right. At that time, and I'm thinking back to my understanding of the first Ebola outbreaks that occurred in Sudan and Zaire, was it framed as something that was of a great danger in hospital settings because of the risk
right.
of spread? Yeah.
I think
rather than community.
Right. Actually, the hospital dangers were probably the, I mean, that's the hallmark of the disease.
Mm-hmm.
You know, what's the first alarm bell that makes people think there's an Ebola outbreak is when you hear about healthcare workers dying.
Mm-hmm.
And that was true in 1976.
Mm-hmm.
The Yambuku outbreak was very much a hospital-associated
mm-hmm.
outbreak,
mm-hmm.
Less so the one in Sudan that
mm-hmm.
year.
Mm-hmm.
And then in 1995, the next really big outbreak in Kikwit was very much hospital associated.
Right.
And I think that's what you need to have a really big outbreak. You need to have healthcare structures involved because they're extraordinarily efficient amplifiers of disease.
Right.
So that you don't have big outbreaks without having a hospital
mm-hmm.
involved.
Mm-hmm.
It was true in the 2005 Marburg outbreak in Wige,
mm-hmm.
Angola.
Right. Right. Yeah, so I suppose just if you could continue and cover. So that was your experience then. I mean, it was a self-limiting outbreak, right?
They all are.
Okay, well, I mean, you tell me what was different about that as opposed to the current one, then, because it was self-limiting in a different way, clearly.
Well, yeah, well, this one isn't self-limiting until it ends, but
okay.
it will.
Right.
The question is not, you know, what makes an outbreak end, because they've all ended.
Okay.
And this one will end.
Mm-hmm.
The question is, why is the scale of any one outbreak different from another one?
Okay.
And what has made this one exceptional, of course, obviously, it's been the numbers, large number of cases, but in order to have that large number of cases, it has to have significant geographic extension.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what's made this one different. And that is almost entirely linked to the mobility of the populations involved in West Africa.
Mm-hmm.
If you look at the other outbreaks, they are reasonably contained because the populations are not... the populations don't move about so much. I mean, the people
mm-hmm.
in Yambuku hung around Yambuku. You know, they didn't, you know, get up one morning and say, you know, I'm going to go to Kinshasa today.
Right.
And it was the same in Kikwit, it was the same in Kampungu. It has been true to a lesser extent in Uganda. The folks in Uganda move about a bit more. So if you look at the outbreaks in Uganda, there have been some satellite outbreaks. So in the Gulu outbreak, there was a significant satellite outbreak in Masindi. And there have been small one or two case satellite outbreaks in other Ugandan outbreaks. But they generally, again, they extinguish very quickly after they get away from the source. And it may be because of the these people are moving outside of their social networks. So if you're a dude on the road with Ebola and you get sick in a town where nobody knows who you are, the odds of the outbreak propagating from there are rather small. What the West Africans have been very good at is going to visit family in other villages or most notably in nearby capital cities. So I don't know Guinea as well as many who've been there, but they what they tell me is that so this outbreak started in Guinea Forestière, where you have a bunch of villages in this area that sort of extends beyond the borders into Sierra Leone and Liberia. And the people that live there all have relatives in Conakry. And, you know, so you know, cousin Bob, who went to Conakry to open up a bakery, you know, people get in the car and go and visit Uncle Bob, and Uncle Bob sends money home and whatnot. And there is a mapping in Conakry that corresponds to Guinea Forestière. So this village tends to have a cluster of people that hang out in Conakry here and whatnot. And there's a lot of movement back and forth. And these and the ability for people to move from village to village is, despite their limited means, is rather good. And so if you have a funeral in village A, people come from, you know, village B, village C, village D, because your family or your extended family exists in a relatively extended geographic area. And so when they come to the funeral and they get infected, and when they go home, they take the disease with them.
Could I just interrupt you a second?
Yeah.
This is all very good, but I wanted to actually try and...
you take me down the road you want to take me down.
I want to get clear, kind of the chronology from your point of view of this outbreak, the emergency response, the kind of the how, what, and when. But as far as possible from your point of view, so rather than secondhand, what you know because of what you actually knew about Ebola at what point. So if we can take it through, I mean, if you think back to, I mean, as I understand it, it first blinks on Medicine Sans Frontières radar in February 2014. Is that right?
Well, this outbreak is in March. Although maybe the people locally knew a bit more about it, but the what the heck's going on here alert got set off in mid March of 2014.
So were you here then?
Here in Brussels, I think I was in one of our training programs where I give some. talks on epidemiology, so I think I was in Spain,
okay,
for 3 days. You know, so
okay.
So I got the email, and you know, they said we're sending the samples off. It looks suspicious. Hilda de Klerk, who was in Bo, has moved to Guinea. She's one of our hemorrhagic fever reference as well, and Michel, who's the other one, who's here, is packing his bags to leave. So already. Two of the three of us were already on their way, so I didn't have to do
is
anything
that,
special.
Is that the core immediate outbreak? Is it you and sorry, just talk me through that.
Well, so there are two of us here in the medical department who maintain a view on the technical matters related to Ebola. That's different from the operations and whatnot. So in terms of the medical. A reference for Ebola, that would be Michelle and myself. Hilda is
Michelle
Van Erp.
Van Erp. Okay.
V-A-N space H-E-R-P. And it's a he, so it's Michelle with one L and no E.
Okay.
And then Hilda de Klerk is the hemorrhagic fever mobile implementing officer. So she's the one who is single and has no kids and can spend lots of time in the field. So she gets to go off to... She was spending a lot of her time in Sierra Leone dealing with Lassa up
previously.
Until that point. Right.
Okay.
So she was under a contract to basically spend some time here with Michelle and I, but spending a lot of her time in Sierra Leone, because that is where our normal, everyday hemorrhagic fever issues stem from. So she was
not in Kenema.
No, well, she's in Bo, so that's not far from Kenema. So Bo was where our project is, and it's about 40 minutes down the road from Kenema, which is where the government of Sierra Leone maintains their center. So she was in there, that area, helping out our Bo project deal with their Lhasa issues when the alarm bells were ringing in Gekedu, which is, I guess, whatever it is, 8-hour drive or whatever. So she grabbed some stuff and headed with some people to Gekedu to sort of be the experienced hemorrhagic fever person to provide some support for them. And at the time, we weren't sure if it was going to be Lhasa or Ebola or whatever.
So they're kind of en route, and you come back first, and then...
So I came, I came back here and just sort of followed out, and then the test came back positive for Ebola that Friday. And Monday they identified it as Ebola Zaire, which we don't call Zaire anymore, but who cares? If you're going to be a historian, you should get into the history of the taxonomy of this disease.
These viruses. That would be part of it,
It's
all been written up in numerous papers.
No, I know Jen's is the guy at the heart of all of that, and driving some people crazy. But anyway,
okay.
It is what it is.
Right.
So then things get going, and I guess it got, you know, the extension to, so it was in Gekedu, it's in Macenta, it's sort of in a couple of villages regionally. Nothing surprised anybody at that point.
Just so to bring it to you, uh-huh. your experience, what point do you head out? I mean, do you?
Well,
what are you saying?
It's mostly it's what operation says. Mm-hmm. You know, I can go at any given moment, but it doesn't make sense for me to be there while Michelle and Hilda are there.
Okay.
So I just sort of say I'm available. Right. You know, and you start clearing your schedule and making sure that when they're and I think I went in early April or mid April. You know, just sort of figuring, all right, they're going to rotate out, I'll you know, go to there. And I didn't know where that would be at the time, because it was very quickly started unrolling the extension across the border. Okay, there was a case in Sierra Leone, and there were a couple of cases in Liberia, and then, then it becomes a question of...
I suppose what I'm trying to get as much as possible is just your own experience, your point of view. So.
Well, so, no, I mean, I'm just watching this unfold, and so the question, you know, so you follow the extension from the field, okay, where are the cases? And the most significant next event was the appearance of cases in Conakry, which was, you know, what, a week and a half later or something like that, not even. So it was not surprising when operations said, all right, we need you to go to Conakry, you know, rather than going into the interior to Gekedu and whatnot. So my first field deployment during that outbreak was to Conakry, and I was there for the second half of April.
So can you just talk through what you saw, what the situation was like, maybe how it... similar or different from previous outbreaks you've seen in Uganda?
Well, so what had been... Well, so, I mean, so I skipped a part, probably.
Okay.
You know, between Uganda in 2000,
yeah.
I also went to Angola in 2005 for the Marburg outbreak there.
Ah.
And I also went to Kampungu in the DRC in 2007 for the Ebola outbreak there.
Mm-hmm.
And I have provided sort of regular support to the field for the other outbreaks. Mm-hmm. Over the course of whatever it's been, 14 years, I've been to the field a few times.
Yeah.
And amongst the things, as I said, I do here is to stay up to date on all the developments in Ebola, which are few and far between, but because this doesn't sort of happen every year. But you stay on top of the research, you get to know the people who work in the labs and whatnot.
And my understanding is it's...
Work on the guideline.
Yeah, I mean, it's a sort of disease that... didn't have sustained research funding, if I can put it that way.
Well, it didn't. It didn't. The bioterrorism fantasy, or whatever you want to call it, that drives a certain amount of funding from the biodefense community has fed into Ebola research, mm-hmm. mostly in terms of development of medical countermeasures.
Mm-hmm.
Mm. So we came into this outbreak and others with a certain amount of stuff that works in the lab in mm-hmm. the non-human primates,
mm.
but not a whole heck of a lot of understanding about the naturally occurring disease mm-hmm. and how rather ordinary things might work. You know, so if you went mm-hmm. and said, well, you know, I can name five different drugs that if you give them to a monkey mm-hmm. at or about the time you give them Ebola, how they will affect their survival.
Mm.
But if you wanted to say, well, what happens when you just give them IV fluids,
mm-hmm.
the laboratory data is much thinner.
Yeah.
And you would think, well, you know, well, why don't we have that information? Well, because nobody's funding that information.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And what people want is something that's specifically directed against the virus.
Yeah.
So that you can say, oh, okay, world, don't even think of deploying Ebola as a bioweapon because we've already got the answer right here.
Yeah.
You know, take that off the table by being prepared in advance.
Mm-hmm.
Which I think most of the people in the world didn't know about until two people from Samaritan's Purse got these things, and then the world suddenly realized that what everyone else in the very small Ebola community knew was that these things have been cooking in the labs for quite some time.
Okay, we're jumping ahead. I want to come on to
direct traffic here.
Let's go back. So I asked you originally how when you arrive in Conakry in April,
what
was similar, what was different? Yeah.
So what was very similar was the all of the things that usually happen when you have an Ebola outbreak.
Mm.
You know, there are various task force meetings that are set up where people from the Ministry of Health and WHO and the usual response agencies, CDC, MSF, WHO, sit about the table and discuss, you know, some of the sort of usually painful things like, you know, those three motorcycles that we received funding for 2 weeks ago are where? And is it time yet to talk about how we will obtain funding for gas for these motorcycles?
Right.
You know, which in retrospect seems kind of ridiculous that the fate of three motorcycles was going to make no difference whatsoever at that point. But anyway, that's what these meetings inevitably come to.
So who's in Conakry at this point? The World Health Organization?
Yeah, MSF, mm-hmm. CDC, WHO, mm-hmm. and the Ministry of Health. Those are the usual mm-hmm. actors. There were a couple others.
Mm-hmm.
I think I saw somebody from mm-hmm. the French, what was it? French Ministry of Foreign Affairs has a medical wing that I think they sent somebody there to sort of see what they could do to help out.
Mm-hmm.
But basically, it's the same old players.
Right. I mean, one question people might have in the future, they might be surprised by this. Why is it that Médecins Sans Frontières was the one to identify, diagnose Ebola first? What was it?
Oh, we happened to be there. That was chance,
yeah. Because you had a malaria treatment center, right?
Right, there was a MSF Geneva was running operations in that area.
Right.
And I think the Ministry of Health had received word and you know, it's a question of, I think different people knew different things at different time, and I think even the local MSF people had heard that there was something bad going on, but it was a specific cluster, I think, of 9 cases and 4 deaths that really got everyone's attention. And it was that point that MSF arranged the sampling and shipment of blood from Gekidu to, as it turns out, it ended up being Lyon because DHL didn't want to handle it and Air France did.
Really?
So it went to Lyon instead of Hamburg.
I'd be interested, I don't know, so if at some point... we spoke at one point about a chronology that MSF has.
Yeah,
so,
I do.
I mean,
I
still haven't got a firm idea of when exactly this was. I know it's sometime in February, I think.
The first day, I think it was in like the, whatever that week of like the 18th of March or something was when I heard about it.
Yeah.
And I think that's when the samples got shipped around that time.
Yeah. But I read some other piece in Time. There was someone called Ella Watson Stryker who was flying out from New York. And I'm pretty sure that was in February.
Maybe.
According to that article. Anyway.
It so could be.
Useful
I,
to go.
Yeah, the, so the, before that third week of March, I can't tell you much about what was going on there.
Okay, so at this roundtable, you've got the usual suspects.
Right.
Including yourself.
Talking about the usual things.
Now, but, can you tell me a little bit about the attitude of the Guinea Ministry of Health?
That was typical. I mean, I guess part of the problem is, in order to control an Ebola outbreak, you have to do a lot of different things. Mm-hmm. You have to find the cases. You have to transport the cases that you find safely to a place to care for them. You have to operate a place that you can care for them, which involves operating a lab that can tell you who's got the disease definitively and who doesn't. You have to identify all of the people who are in contact with those cases in the community. You have to visit these people every day for 21 days. You have to go out and tell people who don't have the disease how not to get it. And then all of this stuff is interdependent and has to be coordinated. The coordination role falls usually to either the Ministry of Health or WHO or sometimes both. And all of these organizations, I mean, both these organizations have different pieces. So you have like the local Ministry of Health people in the Gekedu area, for example, or in Conakry. But then you have the national level people, and how the local and national people interoperate is different from country to country. Then WHO is even worse because you have the WHO country office, you have the AFRO office, and you have the Geneva office. And all of the real competence with Ebola is in Geneva, but the because of the way the WHO governance works, the authority falls to the local and the regional office. And there's an interesting history there, and you can look at it. It's all the fault of the Americans and the Public Health Service and the Surgeon Generals after the war and all that. But anyway.
That you'll do my job.
And the preexistence of PAHO is the Pan-American Sanitary Board before the UN structure was set up. Anyway, so WHO has this issue, and the problem is, of course, that the people who get to wear the hat don't have a lot of experience with Ebola because it's a rare disease.
Right.
So generally the people who have the authority to run the show don't know what they're doing. And that happens all the time.
And are you saying that that is what you saw happening?
Sure, but I mean, you've seen that happen before. I mean, it's... it is rare, unfortunately, that the person who is given the role of being the coordinator of what's going on is somebody who's done this before, or done it well before. Because you have to be a leader and you have to be a manager and, you know, often you pick medical people and you don't go to medical school to learn how to manage and be a leader, unfortunately. You learn how to diagnose diseases and whatnot. Running an Ebola outbreak involves running a big machine with lots of different people running all around, each of whom has to do their job well. And we probably need better managers doing this than you know, than the sort of the normal things to find a medical person who understands the disease. And then this person would be better off as an advisor, and you should have a manager running the show.
I think you said, so I just want to remind you of something that you said at Chatham House talk. Where you were speaking.
I think I said this at Chatham House, exactly.
Well, you did kind of, because you were talking about the failure of coordination. Actually, you kind of left, it was right at the end of your talk. But you used this phrase, which I thought was rather interesting. You said, we get off on the wrong foot pretty much in every outbreak.
Yep.
So, you're kind of saying there that lessons don't get learned from these outbreaks.
Well, or to the extent that the lessons are learned, there are institutional barriers to correcting the deficiencies. If you had a magic wand and said, okay, you know, I happen to know somebody who's well suited to coordinating an Ebola outbreak response, everybody who has the local authority, please step aside and delegate it to this person so that he can get the job done. That never happens. You know, people don't step aside and delegate authority to the person because they happen to be well qualified for what they're doing. And which is interesting because you go to these meetings and you see the people that have been there 1,000 times. Well, not, okay, it's Ebola, it's not 1,000,
no.
But several times before, hanging out and taking notes and occasionally making pained faces when the same, you know, weak leadership manifests itself. Because, you know, well, I mean, because look, I mean, for example, if you work for the US CDC, you're a government agency. You can't say to the sovereign government of Guinea, please step aside and let me run the show here because I know what I'm doing. You know, you can't, and WHO can't say that either. You know, you
can't mount a colonial style military response.
No, you can't. So whatever it is, the outbreak response is not a meritocracy.
Right.
No, and that's always been the case, and I think it's been very much the case throughout this outbreak as well. You make do with what you got, and
From your point of view, is it frustrating to see?
So I'll give you an example. We'll run the clock forward a little bit, just for the purposes of illustration. Let's put ourselves in Monrovia in early July. So this is when nobody understood the scope of what was going to happen in Monrovia. Things were just getting underway, but it was clear that there were more cases than people had sort of expected. And we were sort of at a point where we were getting outbreak extension fatigue. So even MSF, I think we were operating out however many, a half dozen treatment units, and we just weren't in a position to open up another one. We just didn't have the staff to do this. And so our job, I showed up, there were two people there ahead of me. I was the third person in Monrovia, and we were it. And we were the ones that were going to advise the Liberians on how to do this themselves. And also to help Samaritan's Purse. Because Samaritan's Purse, much to their credit, stepped up and said, we're uncomfortable with this, but we see it as our obligation to help these people. And we're ready to do it if you can tell us how we should do it and help us out. So our job there was to empower, facilitate, train Samaritan's Purse. Samaritan's Purse had already been doing this up in Foya, up in the along the border. So the idea was, okay, MSF, Samaritan's Purse was doing a good job running Foya with support from MSF. We're going to try and talk them into doing it here for Monrovia. Samaritan's Purse and the government of Liberia are going to work together, and they'll provide some manpower, and we'll make do with what we have, and things will be okay. And I think the large sort of international agencies sort of realized that things could get bad, so pledges of millions of dollars and euros were made. Material was starting to show up. Warehouses and stocks were filling up with boxes of stuff. Because it's a lot easier to mobilize stuff and money than it is to actually get a machine in operation. Right. So
we must be getting into August now, if that's the case.
No, this is already in July. July.
All right, okay.
You know, it wasn't at the scale that it was, but it was already the people who were there. You know, because a lot of agencies were already there doing other things. And so they said, we don't want this to be horrible, so we're gonna pledge all of this stuff. And so every morning at these coordination meetings, somebody would stand up from whatever agency and say, we've mobilized this much money, and we've got people en route, we've got stuff coming here, and so forth. And you would sit down with the Ministry of Health machine, and we're talking about burial collection, body collection by the burial teams, and 50% of their capacity was offline because one of their vehicles had a problem with one of its tires. And we'd already identified the accumulation of bodies, as a problem, that the people in the, that the bodies aren't being picked up because the system to pick up the bodies is not up to the scale of what was already going on in early July. Because they had, I think they had four teams and two vehicles.
Right.
And the idea is that these two vehicles would be in operation with the two teams, and, they had a capacity of whatever it is.
The 15. Whole country?
No, this is for Monserrato County. And, they could probably do 15 burials a day. And it was clear that many more than 15 cases a day were accumulating, that the calls were coming in. And there were frustrations that people had been calling in and the bodies weren't getting picked up, and bodies were staying in place for 24, 48, 72 hours before they'd get picked up. And so this was an infection risk, and this was also interfering with other people's ability to work. Because it was clear that, you know, people would, you know, somebody would go there to investigate a case and people would say, you go away and come back when you're ready to take care of these bodies. So, I mean, this is clearly an issue. And you think, you know, you said the people are mobilizing huge amounts of resources and it doesn't materialize into a system that can remove bodies because there's a problem with a tire. Mm-hmm. You know?
Right, right.
And, you know, you'd say, like, well, why is this happening?
It's a management issue. I remember some comment on how ironic, I mean, because Liberia is a place where rubber comes from, right?
For the sure.
I think there was a comment about there were similar problems with just getting basic surgical equipment, like rubber gloves.
You know? Right.
They make the rubber, it's shipped somewhere else where they make the gloves, right. But there's no gloves there.
Right, yeah, try and get a good cup of coffee in Colombia. Right. Or a good cup of tea in Sri Lanka. That was a big disappointment. I was there for 6 months and couldn't find a good cup of tea.
Yeah. So Liberia is a critical...
So that was that's a good example of it. But it was much the same in Conakry. I think it was... I mean, one of the most important things to do early on is contact tracing. Mm. You know, how do you get control of an outbreak? You get control of an outbreak where you know you've identified all of the chains of transmission,
yeah.
And every time you identify a case, it comes from a known chain of transmission. It's like, okay, these are the people potentially infected. I've got my eyes on all of them, and everybody who turns up infected comes from the pool of people I've already got my eyes on.
Yeah.
And we identify quickly and we get these people out of the community as quickly as possible. That's when you have things under control. So you need that contact tracing system. Mm-hmm. And I think it was, what was the arrangement? It had been done, I think, with the local Red Cross, and it didn't get anywhere. And it was being taken over by the Ministry of Health, but the Ministry of Health didn't have money for it. Mm-hmm. And the people that were providing technical support for it at that point was the CDC, and they didn't have a budget for it. And I think MSF was basically passing money under the table to CDC to pay the contact tracers so that it would get up and running, because the money that was supposed to come through WHO to the Ministry of Health was following this sort of normal administrative pathway that everyone has to sign off on. And so the funds had been made available, but they didn't actually become cash in the hands of somebody who could pay off these people to do their job. And so, you know...
So that's extraordinary. So MSF, whose expertise is in medical emergency response, you're now describing a story where you're actually having to get involved in something that's not at all on your remit, right?
We've done contact tracing before, but that had been, okay, who's going to do that, you know, because everyone has to sort of say what they're going to do. And you know, MSF, this was like, Conakry was the... you know, one of these multiple places. And so we were focusing on the treatment unit, which is our sort of our strong point.
But your own people would do the contact tracing?
For example, our people were doing contact tracing in Gekedu.
Yeah.
But in Conakry, the Ministry of Health is there. They've got the people. Yeah. They've got the network of community health workers and whatnot. But they need to be, mobilized, paid, and all of the, you know, you have to just do the things that it requires to engage the human resources to do the task. And this requires money and management. And the management was kind of there, but the money wasn't there. So MSF basically said, well, we've got money. Mm. We will quietly slip it to the people who have the titular administrative role here and get things going until the money that should be doing this actually materializes.
Right. What I'm saying is different is that that's moving into a role of health infrastructure. You're plastering over the wound, if you like, the gap.
Sure. We're filling the gap until the system can lurch into motion and do what it should do. And I think after I've been there a couple of weeks, that happened.
I did.
Yeah. The official funding stream through WHO to the Ministry of Health took on some semblance of regularity, and that we could discontinue our financing of the system.
I mean, how would you characterize the attitude of the Liberian government at this stage? Have they woken up? Back in Liberia.
Okay, so we're back. Because all of that with the funding stuff, that was Conakry in April.
Oh, it was Conakry. Sorry. Right. Okay. Sorry.
I used Liberia in July for the tire issue.
Oh, that was the tire issue. Okay. So when we were talking about this, it was... Okay, I'll make that clear. But to come to Liberia,
sure.
I'm which is why you were talking about the logistical problems there as well. Were there other issues besides tires on vehicles or?
All of this. I mean, it was true in all of the different aspects of outbreak control. Mm-hmm. First of all, it was almost entirely the Liberian Ministry of Health taking this on with very little assistance from MSF at that point. Mm-hmm. I mean, we were, again, one or two people in these meetings.
Yeah.
You had all of these people who their normal job was to run the Ministry of Health. Mm-hmm. They got all of the right pieces. There's a lot. I was optimistic at that point that they had all of the pieces in place, but they just didn't. They couldn't do two things. They couldn't scale the services to meet the scale of the epidemic, and they couldn't manage the services that they'd set up.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, they're bright people and knew, okay, we need to have an alert line that people can call in and tell us when somebody's sick or somebody's dead.
Mm-hmm.
And they did it. And the calls kept flooding in and flooding in. And at some point, that system got overwhelmed.
Mm-hmm.
Another problem is that, sure, these people can write down dead body in this location reported at this time, but then someone has to go and pick it up.
Mm-hmm.
So the capacity of the system was underscaled for just about everything.
Mm-hmm.
So they did all of the right stuff that would have matched a outbreak on the scale that we'd faced in years past. But right. And... you know, I guess there's just a need to think.
Okay, but can we be a bit more specific? Because one of the key moments, as I understand it, was when the government decided to quarantine West Point, this area.
Yeah, well, that was...
So, my question is, I mean, a lot of people say... Why would you want to do that? Because, you know... You're just forcing people to hide cases and trying to escape and all that and all this. But that was criticized for the reason that people argue that actually exacerbated the transmission.
We said that to the president right as soon as they did it.
Right.
West Point is kind of a special place in Monrovia. It's a stigmatized ghetto. It has a history of unrest.
Mm-hmm.
And it's also a place where people are sort of have a transient lifestyle. So there are a lot of people in and out. There's a lot of commercial traffic through there. So I think the naive assumption was, you know, we hear about cases that are there. There was this, because it's an isolated community, they had developed their own response. They said, no one's helping us. We're going to help ourselves. They set up a community containment center there. With some help from the Ministry of Health, and there was a sort of a desire to be self-sufficient, and so it got a lot of attention. And I think when things started to go wrong, there was a need to sort of, well, we got to clamp down, because that's what you do with places where unruly sorts behave in ways that you don't like. You clamp down. And we'll seal this off, and that'll solve the problem. And then we said, well, it only solves the problem or helps solve the problem if you're containing something.
Mm-hmm.
But if you look at where our cases in Monrovia are coming from, they're coming from all over the city.
Mm-hmm.
As a matter of fact, because West Point did not make use of the existing treatment units, none of the cases that were there reported there came from West Point. So West Point actually was a empty spot on the map of cases, because nobody's coming from West Point, because they're all staying there.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, you could make the argument that closing off West Point would have protected West Point from the rest of Monrovia.
Right.
And so we said, you know, we said this doesn't help contain anything, because Ebola is all over the Monserrato County.
Mm-hmm.
And all you are doing is destroying any relationship you have with the community, which is what you will need to get them to report cases and allow you to follow contacts and all of this normal stuff.
So destroying trust.
Right, and we've learned this in every outbreak, that you cannot engage in outbreak control without the willing participation, enthusiastic participation of the affected population. And anything you do that gets in the way of that causes problems.
Yeah.
Well, we said, I mean, this is, you know, the reason that there was Ebola in Monrovia was because we did not have the trust and cooperation of the population in Guinea Forestière.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if we had established a working relationship with them in March and April, there wouldn't have been any cases in Monrovia.
This reminds me of something else you said at Chatham House, which maybe we could expand upon. Use this phrase that we have a marketing problem.
Yeah.
So just to expound, what do you mean? You, in your own words, I mean, I could.
Well, so, I mean, what do you need to do in outbreak control? You have to identify cases, you have to identify contacts, you have to bring the cases into a place where you can confirm that they have the disease, and if so, care for them in a protected environment.
Mm-hmm.
And you have to identify the people that may have become infected, mm-hmm. the contacts, and keep an eye on them.
Mm-hmm.
And it's easy to see what's in it for the sort of the greater good, but what's in it for them?
Mm-hmm.
Well, for the people who are sick, you have to offer some sort of hope of a better outcome.
Yep.
And unfortunately, most of the people that end up going, well, it's no longer most, but let's say half-ish, of the people who go into a treatment unit don't come out, or don't come out alive.
Mm-hmm.
And if the treatment units are seen as places where one goes to die, well, you know, crap, we'll do that at home, in the comfort of my family and around surrounded by people I know and love, which is exactly what you don't want to happen with Ebola.
Mm-hmm.
And then for the contacts, well, what's in it for them to sort of say how they're doing every day? Well, if they get sick, well, they're just going to haul me away to this place where I hear that they're harvesting organs and drawing blood to sell to pharmaceutical companies and whatnot. And, you know, and every time the people in the funny Land Cruisers knock on my door, my neighbors look at me funny, you know, and say, what's wrong with you that these strange people come and ask you how you're doing every day? Stay out of my yard. Don't play with my children, you know. So they would prefer not to have these visits, and this is, you know, why in Guinea Forestière, you know, we just didn't get a good handle on things. And there was a very motivated part, you know, subset of the population that threw rocks and, you know, makes it clear that we're not welcome and go away.
Yeah.
That's our marketing problem. So, I mean, if we come out of this outbreak with a therapeutic agent that's approved and useful and improves outcomes, that will address part of our marketing problem. If we come out of it with a vaccine that offers protection, that will also, I mean, that'll be our big carrot, more carrots.
Well, shall we talk a little bit about drugs and vaccines and the ethics of all this? I don't know if you've got, I mean, we've been going already for 48. Are you okay to?
A little bit. I mean, my opportunity to eat lunch is gone, but I'll.
Well, I was.
I've got some chocolate biscuits. I bought from the UK. That was my lunch as well.
if it helps, I've also missed lunch, so I mean, I don't know. It's up to you guys. But
what time is your next meeting
around lunch? No, I just. I mean, I've been out of the office for a week, so basically, I'm playing catch up on all the other salts. I don't have another meeting. I just have stuff to catch up on.
I just want to kind of explore a little bit, and you can do this any way you like, I suppose, and I can prompt questions. So, I mean, so there are two key branches. One is in the period where there are limited supplies of drugs like ZMapp, which there seems to be some anecdotal evidence can help in an emergency situation. I understand that various MSF treatment centres, there were debates about the ethics of whether you could give some patients ZMapp and not others. So I'd just be interested if you could explain the sort of decision you made around that. And then the second question will come, we can hold for later, comes when everyone gets together in Geneva to talk about the you know, how these vaccine trials are going to be run. There's a fierce debate about whether it's ethical to have a placebo arm.
Oh, yeah.
So if you just explain where, I mean, there must be lots of discussions within MSF.
Yeah. Well, mean, there's a lot of stuff to discuss here, so.
We don't have to do it all now.
Well, there are questions around what is the best way. You have to remember what we're mm-hmm. starting with here.
Yeah.
You have agents that show some promise in laboratory animals,
mm-hmm.
and then other agents that have some theoretical benefit based on somebody's cousin's PhD thesis that showed that this has an anti-inflammatory effect that might have some relevance in Ebola, you know. And then, so you have to decide, okay, what works
mm-hmm.
and what's available.
Mm-hmm.
And what I want is stuff that works and is available.
Mm-hmm.
But that's, or rather stuff that I know works and is available. And that,
mm-hmm.
getting to that point is a difficult thing. Mm-hmm. So unfortunately what we had back, you know, go mm-hmm. back several months, was we had
mm-hmm.
we had drugs that we had reason to believe mm-hmm. should work because of their efficacy in non-human primates,
mm-hmm.
but these are in short supply.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they're not licensed for use. They're experimental or investigational agents.
Mm-hmm.
And then we had some other things that had been licensed for other purposes.
Mm-hmm.
That were available in larger quantities, but for which we had less evidence of efficacy. And there's sort of a spectrum there.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And so the ones that had the greatest hope behind them, mm-hmm. but were in the shortest supply, so the poster child for this is ZMAP, the monoclonal antibodies.
Yeah.
Can we hang out for just a little while, or you need us out of here?
At one, we booked at 2, so it's just to know if you have still long, if it's 5, 10 minutes or half an hour.
In between? I don't know.